Hey everyone, this is Free Food for Thought, a student-run, student-focused podcast here to feed your curiosity. I'm Nathaniel.
And I'm Marshall, and today we're sitting down with Ian Wood. Ian Wood is a professor emeritus at the University of Leeds, where he taught for almost 40 years before his retirement in 2015. Professor Wood received his undergraduate, master's, and PhD from Corpus Christi College at Oxford University.
Professor Wood is a leading expert in late Roman culture, the barbarian kingdoms of the Middle Ages, 18th, 19th, and 20th century historiography of the barbarian invasions of the Roman Empire, and many more research fields dealing with late antiquity.
Thank you so much for sitting down with us today, Professor Wood. It is a pleasure to have you on campus.
Pleasure.
So what caused you to study history and classics? Was there a particular moment growing up where you knew that you wanted to study those fields, or was there a particular individual or particular class that really inspired you to study those areas?
Well, at school, school 13 to 18-year-old, I had a very good history teacher, and I couldn't make up my mind which way I would go for history or English, and because I got very slightly better grades in history, I went on to do history at Oxford. In Oxford, I went to a college which actually had no historian teaching at the time. So we were farmed out to teachers in other colleges, and we had no choice in our first term. I'd gone up assuming that I would work on the 17th, 18th centuries, but one of my teachers in my first year, a chap called Henry Meyer Harting, so excited me about the post-Roman period that I thought I would stick with that. And then I was very lucky in my first full term. So we had a term of prelims, and then the course started properly. I had a chap called Peter Brown, who is currently at Princeton, who has been through Berkeley and so forth. And he taught me, and he basically inspired me to stick with that period. And I've never really looked back. Because I got a sort of decent enough degree, I stayed on, and actually I did my doctorate with somebody who worked on the Barbarian West, Michael Wallace Hadrill, and I've never really shifted out of that area. Although I have done quite a bit of work on slightly later period, but on mission in a slightly later period. That was because the professor at Leeds, when I first went there, Peter Sawyer, who was a Viking expert, and he wanted my opinion on certain Viking age texts to do with the Christianization of Scandinavia. And so I ended up doing a bit of work on Scandinavian Christianization, and have since worked on Christianization in the Slav lands and even in Russia. And then I've also added to that a certain amount of interest in the Anglo-Saxons, and particular Anglo-Saxon sculpture. But that's something that fed directly from being in Leeds, where you're on the edge of the Northumbrian kingdom, where getting up to see Anglo-Saxon sites is easy, and so forth. So that was a natural development. And then I've also done a book on the historiography of the fall of the Roman Empire, and the way in which the interpretation of the fall of the Roman Empire is deeply integrated into the politics of the period from the 17th century through to the present day.
Yeah. So kind of going on that, I find historiography kind of super interesting. And for our audience, is there any way you could give kind of a general explanation of what the field of historiography is and kind of the previously general assumptions around what happened during the fall of the Roman Empire and how historiography and looking at that has kind of changed over time?
Okay. So historiography is basically how people write about the past. It may be about the immediate past. What I was talking about was people writing about the period from 300 to 700. And essentially, in the modern debates, almost all go back to developments in the 18th century. And the developments in the 18th century really were concerned with how you understood the Roman Empire and whether the Roman Empire was really a model for the Bourbon monarchy in France. So you got the monarchists arguing that the Roman Empire was a good thing and that the barbarians were really bad, and the anti-monarchists really taking an opposite line on that. There was some kickback to that. Above all, Gibbon in England took a rather different line and put a lot more emphasis on culture and on also on the what he saw as the malign force of religion. So he saw religion and barbarism as the fall of the Roman Empire. But the big debates were rather more about the empire as a political force and whether this was or was not a bad thing. The early 19th century, in other words, immediately after the French Revolution, you get some scholars seeing the Romans as a good thing and seeing the barbarians as an oppressive group who come to form the new aristocracy. So in a sense, they upturned the previous model. In the previous model, the Bourbon monarchy was the nasty oppressive force, and that was could be compared with the Roman Empire. In a model that emerges in the early 19th century, the barbarians come in and they're the nasty oppressive force and they oppress the indigenous population of Western Europe, and they create a huge period of oppression, particularly of the French. And that model actually gets picked up in Italy, where a chap called Manzoni sees the barbarians coming in as being the beginning of a period of almost non-stop oppression in Italy by outside forces. And this gets turned in Italy into part of the intellectual case for the Risorgimento. In the second half of the 19th century, things change quite a bit with Germany becoming more forceful. As Germany unites, so German intellectuals saw the Germans, we wouldn't call them Germans any longer, but the barbarian peoples, they saw the Germans as the origins of Germany. And so they saw the Germans as a really good thing, and they promoted the success of the Germans in overthrowing the Roman Empire. That, to cut a very long story short, becomes central in 1914. In the 1914-18 war, basically speaking, you get the German scholars pushing the idea that the barbarians had been the model for the ideal triumph of the German state. The failure of the Germans in 1918 really sort of upsets that model. Hitler picks it up again. 1945, that model really collapses completely. And basically speaking, after 1945, very, very few people talk about this period because it had become so contaminated, it was either interpreted as being a period in which the Germans triumph, in which case that was a great thing if you're a German, or in which the Roman Empire was oppressed, in which case it was a dreadful thing for everybody else. And it's not really until the very end of the 1960s that you start to get a major new voice, and that's essentially Peter Brown with his publication in 1971, The World of Late Antiquity. And he certainly drew on current scholarship, and particularly on current scholarship that had largely been associated with religion. So he turns to the French scholars who had been looking at the patristics, and he basically says, hang on, we've got to integrate the intellectual and cultural vigor of Christianity into this picture. You can't just argue that this is an issue of collapse caused by barbarians or whatever. And I mean, the issue of collapse or not has continued. And very recently, a new twist has come along, particularly because of concerns about climate change. So people have been looking at the evidence for climate. And because we've now got the scientific evidence, people knew that there was a plague in the 6th century, but exactly how bad it was and why it was caused has become clear from the analysis of ice cores in the Arctic and the Antarctic, where they've basically managed to show that there was a massive, great volcanic eruption somewhere in the southern hemisphere in 536 and another one in 540. And those two led to summers when there was no sun. And that meant complete failure of the crops and therefore starvation. And therefore also wild animals moving in from what are sometimes called plague reservoirs, because there's always plague somewhere out there among the animals. But if the animals don't bring it in to human contact, then you don't have much of a problem, and you get a period of plague. And there's now a big debate: how big was the plague? Did the plague contribute to what happens in the 6th century? So we've got a new twist, which is obviously very, very closely associated with current concerns.
I'm a bit curious about your thoughts on the value of studying history for students. Having been a professor for quite a while, just in my life here at CMC, and even just back in my earlier years of education, I think history often wasn't given the sort of importance that I feel it should often be given. Even here, like my first history class I'm taking right now at CMC. So do you think, I think my first question would be, is history taken seriously enough in our modern times in the education system? Are students given enough pressure to actually take enough historical classes, learn enough about history? And a follow-up to that as well would be, if there is this gap in studies of history, how can this niche be filled in some way?
It's not an easy job. I think that part of the problem is that if you're going to talk about is history relevant, the answer is yes, it's relevant because it's always being exploited. So the points that I was just making about the way in which discourse about, say, plague and climate change feeds into history, or the way in which history fed into debates about the First and Second World Wars. Yes, history is always being used in current discourse. So in that sense, it's really important. The problem is that is a historiographical topic. And that means historiography means juggling at two levels. First of all, you've got to know what happened or what the sources tell us happened. So you've got to know the ancient period. And then you've got to know all the issues of how it's interpreted and how that feeds into wider debates. So the difficulty that a historian has, and the difficulty really that somebody trying to sell history has, is you've got to say to people, well, yeah, you've got to be really enthused by what happened in the past. You've got to find that exciting. You've got to go out and get that. But if somebody's going to say to you, is it relevant? You've then got to add something on top of that, which is the historiography, which is basically something that, in a sense, comes as a secondary development in your learning. You can't do it all at once. You've got to have some knowledge of the course of events before you can start talking about the way in which it's been interpreted and whether that has relevance to the modern period or whether that's being misused. Because as often as not, the issue about the use of history in the modern period is its misuse and not its actually correct use. Does that give you some sort of an answer? But the trouble is, there is this really difficult two-tier thing. You've got to get the facts right, or as near right as you can, and you then got to look at interpretation. And they are completely interrelated, but in a sense, one has to come after the other.
As a quick follow-up, you mentioned selling history in some way. How did you do that as a professor? Or did people just, were they just drawn to taking these classes?
I think people get drawn to taking classes, and it's to some extent, there's an issue of whether there is somebody, it may not be you, but somebody in the section of history that in your university who is charismatic enough to create an interest in, say, the big outline history courses. So, I mean, it wouldn't really have mattered. I mean, in my first years at Leeds, it didn't matter that I wasn't particularly sort of charismatic in terms of grabbing people in. There was this chap, Peter Sawyer, who was a great charismatic lecturer. So you've got to have somebody there to inspire the initial enthusiasm. Once you get beyond that, then the relationship with the individual teacher, you may not need the sort of big charisma. It may be that you really, really get on with a particular tutor because you like the way he thinks or she thinks, the way they describe something, and so forth.
Yeah, so kind of when you were talking about the value of history, you talked about how often in today's context it's the misuse of history that we really see in references. And, you know, I think a group that's kind of very often misinterpreted is kind of the barbarians and the Franks that come to challenge Roman rule. So I was wondering if you could outline kind of the common misconceptions of the barbarians, specifically the Franks and other groups like that, and what's a more accurate way of understanding them?
Well, there's a straightforward issue about their savagery. I mean, these people are, if you're in the camp that sees the barbarians as destroying civilization, as some modern historians have said, there's a straightforward issue of their barbarism, their destructive nature. And a lot of work has really been done in recent years to point to the fact that basically these are guys who've been living on the frontiers of the Roman Empire for a very, very long time, and they're not really so very, very different from the Romans. And some of them actually probably had careers in the Roman army. So there's an issue of trying to get rid of the notion of barbarism, even if you're sticking with the word barbarian. There's a related question, which is how many of them there were. The 19th century, those who saw the barbarians as a good thing and those who saw the barbarians as a bad thing, saw the barbarians as overwhelming in number. Nowadays, we're really much more inclined to say, really, they weren't sizable in their numbers, and the reason why they win is that actually the Roman army is in a mess, and the Roman civil wars and so forth. There's also a related question which sort of goes to the issue of identity. There's a sort of very strong, there was a very strong notion that the barbarian tribes were very easily labeled, and that here you had a group that were Franks, and here you had a group that were Burgundians, and a group that were Goths. And this was really quite strongly developed in the in early 20th century Germany, and particularly by the Nazis, because they wanted the barbarians to be biologically pure. It goes into the whole issue of Nazi notions of biological purity. And one of the other big things that has changed in recent years is an attack on the notion that these groups are biological. They're very, very much more mixed than was thought. There's an emphasis on their self-identification rather than on any on any biological element in the barbarian tribes, and therefore an emphasis on the mutability of identification that groups develop, and some groups sort of just fade away because they lose their identity, and the peoples in those groups attach to other groups, whether other barbarian groups or just integrate into the Roman world. I would have thought those are probably the main issues there.
Yeah, that was super helpful and a really good kind of primer on the whole subject.
I'm going to go a bit broad again, I think, and ask you about how do you go about determining the truest account of history in your own experience, or how have you seen other historians go about it?
That's not easy, but it's easiest where you've got more than one source. So if you've got a set of sources, and particularly if you've got a set of different types of sources, so if you've got a historical narrative, if you've got a saint's life, if you've got a chronicle, if you've got some speeches, if you've got some coins, if you've got some really well-dated archaeology, you can do a pretty good job in identifying roughly what's happening. The big problems come in those periods, and there are quite a lot of them in the late Roman and early Middle Ages, or those decades where really you've only got one source. And what you have to do is just say to yourself, do I trust this guy? And I mean, very often my answer would be, no, I don't trust this guy. And so what then do you do? I think then, in fact, you shift to a different level of historiography. Rather than talking about historiography, modern historiography, you have to start to deconstruct the original source. So if you take the Franks, well, our major source is Gregory of Tours. For a lot of the time, he is our only text. And therefore, until very recently, everybody has just accepted his narrative absolutely straight, even where there are moments when we can when his narrative is contradicted by other sources. Nowadays, for a variety of reasons, it might be archaeology, it might be dating of papyri or whatever. Nowadays, there are moments when we can actually put our finger on these texts and say, actually, no, we've got to reject this. The narrative won't work. And so the issue then shifts away from saying, can I tell the true story? But it shifts to being, can I explain why this chap isn't telling the true story? So in a sense, the writer of your evidence becomes the narrative rather than the fact being the narrative.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one question I had kind of building off that is, how has kind of increases in innovations in technology, in particularly ways that you can do archaeological digs or different things that previously would not have been possible, how has that affected the field of classics and unveiled kind of new discoveries that previously were unknown?
A lot has changed in terms of the ability to date exactly. Most of the developments of came, I suppose, from around 1950 onwards. Ability to do carbon-14 thermoluminescence dating and so forth. So that now you can dig up a site and you can say, well, we can be pretty sure that this level belongs to this and so forth. And for instance, with the fall of the Roman Empire, there was always a tendency, if you dug a Roman site and you came to a level of burning, to say, ah, the level of burning is the moment the barbarians come in, so we can say this is 410. Well, I mean, obviously that's pretty stupid in lots of ways, because villas burn down because they have thatched roofs or whatever. I mean, it's not just barbarians coming in. So dating has become a lot more sophisticated, and that's changed things. An ability to analyze human bones, human remains, looking at the genetic sequence, is becoming important, particularly with regard to trying to identify whether a cemetery is a Roman cemetery or a non-Roman cemetery, or whether it's a mixture, and whether you can tell which sort of body is of which group. That will become hugely more important. I mean, it is now possible, but until very recently, it's been so expensive just to sort of get the sequencing on a single skeleton was thousands of dollars. I mean, now it's been that cost has come right down, so that you can do complete cemeteries or whatever. So that sort of thing has changed very dramatically as well.
Yeah, that's super interesting and good to know. And kind of one final question I had was, I noticed when prepping for this interview, you were involved with an application for a historic abbey to become a UNESCO World Heritage Site. And I was wondering what you thought about the kind of value of preserving historical sites and monuments, and what's the best way to do that in today's era?
Well, first of all, I should say that we didn't manage to get that church or those two churches onto the UNESCO site, the UNESCO list, which I think was a mistake, obviously, because I was involved in doing the work for it. I mean, UNESCO listing is terribly important in the sense that people will go to a UNESCO site and it will attract attention and so forth. My own view is that making historical sites accessible, interpreting them, preserving them, they're crucial both for scholarship and also for making people aware of their environment, their past, and so forth. And there are some places that people are immensely proud of the past of their region. If you go to the north of England, to the area north of where I am, up to Newcastle, I mean, the pride in Hadrian's Wall is enormous. So any new find on Hadrian's Wall gets a huge amount of interest. Although we didn't manage to get Weymouth Jarrow onto the UNESCO list, we got so much local interest in it. I mean, there had always been a certain level of interest, but suddenly that interest went much, much deeper into the community and a much greater pride. So I think that's where I would stand on that.
And just as one quick final question, a soft one, I was wondering if you'd like to share something to our listeners, just a book or a fact or a song, anything that's been on your mind lately.
that's not easy. The book that I keep on going back to anyway is Brown's World of Late Antiquity. I mean, partly because I've been writing in a sense what may be seen as a return to that world. So that would be the thing that I would probably go back to most. But I mean, it's not very recent.
Yeah, so that is all that we have for today. Thank you so much for sitting down with us. And to our audience, remember to stay hungry.